Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. It seems possible that President Obama's mind has been so twisted by his Ivy League education that he actually believes the guff he's spouting. If he is honestly mistaken, does that reduce his moral guilt? Well, we don't have to talk just about Obama here, because the question would apply to all of these leaders with corrupt policies. First of all, there is a sense in which I would say, yes, he does believe it. It's not as though he sits back in the Oval Office and chuckles and says, I really put it over on these people, you know, when I criticize the wealthy. I love the wealthy. You know, I'm in cahoots with them, etc. That would be he doesn't believe it. There's no doubt that he believes it. I don't think Hitler, to change the example, was lying when he said how monstrous the Jews were. I don't think even Al Capone disbelieved his justification for bootlegging. So on that level, but if you say he believes his ideas, how did he get his ideas? How did he reach them? By what mental process? Did he get his ideas by perceiving reality or by evasion, emotionalism, whim worship, authoritarianism, quote, intuition, etc., etc.? Then I have to say, if his ideas came from that source, they are definitely dishonest, and that makes him dishonest. Not that he doesn't believe them, but what he had to do to his mind and what evasions he still has to do to believe them. Now, the fact that you have to evade to maintain a belief doesn't mean it stops being a belief. It remains being a belief, but it's a belief sustained by the fact that you won't look at anything that contradicts it. You are dishonest, but you still are believing it. So the question of Obama or all the others are, can you reach this viewpoint honestly? And specifically, can you reach nihilism honestly? I would say absolutely not. You can reach any view just about which offers a value to be achieved by mistake, but you can't by honest mistake reach the view of let's destroy everything. Are certain careers by nature more second-handed than others? Like an actor or a comedian who derives his career from the approval of others. No, you're simply wrong. Actor and a comedian are just like everybody else. They need approval, but that is irrelevant to judging them. What counts in judging them is the method of thought, the method of action, how they create what they create, whether it's a stand-up gig or whatever it is. In a society in which you function by trade, everybody depends on, quote, approval. They depend on people evaluating their product enough to pay them for it. And Ayn Rand depended on royalties in order to live. And the royalties depended on people liking her books. So in that sense, it depended on approval. That doesn't make her or any of these people a second-hander. Nor does it mean that she wrote with them in mind. But it does mean that she certainly wanted people to read the book after she wrote it in and of and for herself. I've noticed that whenever Ayn Rand and others such as you and Jerome Brooks are interviewed or debated, they always know what to answer almost instantly. I may know the answer, but I would be completely unsure how to express myself, and I may have to think. How do you get to such a level where one can answer questions like that? Well, I would say two things, both of which involve a huge amount of time. First is you have to learn. You have to learn the essentials of the fields you're dealing with and the interconnections and a lot of the concretes. So you learn it in a reality-oriented way. And it took me, I'm almost ashamed to say, I started looking at objectivism in 1951, and it was more or less full-time for over 30 years before I felt I understood it and, I can answer anything. Well, I mean, I could look like I could answer anything earlier, but it is a long time to really learn all the aspects and interconnections in a reality-oriented way. And the other really crucial thing is experience. Experience in answering questions, because what you have to do is extract the essence of the question. People put all kinds of irrelevancies and side issues, or they hint at the question, and you have to be able right away, to grasp it. And only after you do that, time after time, Ayn Rand used to observe that there's only so many questions. We even joked at one point, a number of us, we would assign numbers. Oh, that's 37B and 14A, etc. But once you get the categories and the principle, then you can answer questions indefinitely. For instance, if I understand capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism, and I understand how it works with bakeries, and I understand how it works with roads, and then somebody comes up and says, what do you do with fire departments? I don't have to say, my God, I just don't know how that would be. You immediately subsume it under what you know. Now, I think a crucial thing that experience does is how you treat it afterwards. I was lucky or conscientious, whatever you call it. I always, from day one, played back in my mind any answer I gave after any class or, Q&A, whatever. I would play it back to see what I should have said instead. It's like I would edit it, and it would come back. The parts that I was uneasy with when I was speaking would come back immediately. Just open your mind and just walk, and it would be there. And you edit and say, oh, I see. I got this mixed up with that, or I should have given this example. That was too abstract. And if you do that, year after year, hundreds and hundreds of questions, you get to the point where you can jump to the essence of the question and the wording. But, you can still get stumped, and you can get stumped in embarrassing situations. I'll tell you just this story. At the very beginning of my career, just as Atlas came out, I had to, for logistical reasons, answer questions from an audience of hundreds when Ayn Rand was on the way and she would be coming in 5 to 10 minutes. And I had never faced an audience before, and I was very nervous. I looked, younger than I was. And I didn't know how I could control the audience, whether I know what to say. And Ayn Rand said to me, don't worry, it's all, you know all the basic things. So I got up before the audience and said, we're going to have questions for a few minutes. One hand went up, and I said, yes, sir. He said, what is the objectivist position on Moby Dick? I had never read it. I knew there was a whale in it. And I just felt it would be letting objectivism down if I said, I don't know because I've never read it. So I kind of weaseled my way out by saying, well, that's a very complex book. Could you tell me what aspect you have in mind? And I kept narrowing it down until he gave me a philosophic question, like one character did to another. What do you think of that? And then, of course, when it was philosophy, I could answer. Now, today, I would have enough confidence to say, sorry, try another book because I had never read that. But in those days, your very first question, you want to make a good impression. Now, here's somebody very upset with Occupy Wall Street. And he wants to know, is one allowed to slap another across the face for trashing values one holds in high esteem? After all, that is not force or damage, doesn't even leave a mark. Isn't the slap just an elevated form of freedom of expression? No, it's not. It's physical force. When you talk about force here, we mean any invasion of your body or your property. Anything you do to the body that he doesn't want or ask for is something that he gets involuntarily. In other words, it is forced on him. You are threatening here his liberty, and you are threatening his ability to exist and support himself if you have the right to come in and inflict pain on him. You have no freedom to express yourself by your fists. If you are exasperated, you have two choices. Just forget about it. Look away. You know, do something else. And figure other people will look after it, or it's too awful to look at. And that's not always wrong. Or then you figure out what would really stop these people. And believe me, it wouldn't be a slap on the face. I am a member of my school student government at a Christian university. A student appealed for our support for a lesbian, gay, and transgender club. Currently, and he has to decide whether to vote for it. Currently, I am thinking I will vote against supporting the club because transsexualism, which is part of the club, which is supported, is immoral. What would be the moral vote? I would agree with you. I would vote against letting the club in. The gay and the lesbian, I have no problem with it. Certainly allow them in. But when you get to the transgendered, you'll have to see my past podcast on that. I regard that as a metaphysical assault on reality, as a thorough corruption, as something I would never voluntarily associate with. Now you could say, well, why penalize the innocent members in that group just because there's one that you don't like? My answer is because the innocent ones allowed the association. They endorsed the connection of them to the transgendered one. So what they have in common is not a unique for a different form of love from the conventional. It's not love, a different form of love, but a different form of opposing conventional sex. And that is not, if that is a basis, they are not value-oriented. I would totally reject this. If you want to get in, no matter how many of you are good, I would say don't join with one person who supports the bad. I heard you say that your dim theory has been confirmed and verified during the writing process. So why do you still insist on calling it the dim hypothesis? Well, because in my opinion, it is not proved conclusively until the last chapter. All the rest is the mounting of evidence. So it seems to me like an arbitrary claim to say, like, the dim truth or the scientific discovery of dim or whatever. It's an arbitrary claim. The only thing that dim is objectively to an audience as reading a book is a hypothesis. So that's why. How is it that the richest of people are often the most sympathetic to communist or socialist principles? Well, I would say those ones whom it's true, and it is, I think, a great many, are the ones to whom their riches are unearned, such as Orrin Boyle, or inherited without work, such as, you know, the Rockefellers and the Fords, etc. And the other reason is if they are Christians and they feel guilty, of course, that brings them to opposition to a selfish system. So if you work for your money and you believe in life in this world and reason, you won't be that kind of rich. But there's a lot of rich who have those alien views. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.